This is David Duke. And this is David Duke, and this is the David Duke Internet Web Radio Broadcast, broadcasting live to the entire world. A program of vital interest to Europeans and people of European descent, wherever they may live, but certainly important to all people on the planet. And I'm actually broadcasting in a different country today. I'm currently in Turkey, and I'm doing some lectures to some major intellectual intellectual leaders in Turkey on the nature of Zionism and the so-called Jewish question. And it's so important for people to understand around the world that Zionism is not simply a form of modern colonialism in Israel. It goes far deeper than that. It's a problem that's been around for a long, long time. And my series that I'm doing right now is on the roots of anti-Semitism. What is anti-Semitism? That's a word that's a terrible smear word when it's used against an individual, and it's used incredibly flippantly and ridiculously. Anyone who criticizes Israel today, anyone who exposes some of the elements of Jewish supremacism and racism, and by the way, there is such incredible extremism in the Jewish state, major organizations, and among the Jewish community, both in Israel and around the world. It's amazing that we should be called anti-Semitic for exposing this kind of intense hatred. I was discussing just a few days ago on this program that in the White House we have a new Jewish head of policy, Mr. Bolton, and I have a picture of him on davidduke.com with a number of his brethren, his friends, from the Chabad-Lubavitch movement. The Chabad-Lubavitch movement is a major Jewish organization of tens of millions of dollars, tens of thousands of people all over the world. Obviously, they have big influence. They have one of their rabbis come to the White House and instruct other Jews in the White House. Apparently, they have enough of them that they can come in and do these kinds of instructions. Well, the Lubavitch movement, the Chabad-Lubavitch movement, is extremely anti-Gentile. I mean, it is so hatefully anti-Gentile, it's hard for me to explain it fully. But I do have many quotes from their own websites, from their own writings, their own leaders, and they basically equate Gentiles with animals. And I'm not exaggerating, ladies and gentlemen. And their essential philosophy is that Gentiles have a satanic or an evil soul, that Gentiles are in the animal kingdom, whereas Jews are something special. In fact, Jews, according to them, are the literal sons of God. And that the purpose of Gentiles is to, quote, serve Jews, to make a very nice and comfortable word for Jews. Now, this is pretty strong stuff. But people who adhere to this philosophy are now in the White House, the United States of America, in fact, is saying prayers. It's an incredible situation, but it's typical of the reality of the hidden nature of Jewish supremacism. Now, am I supposed to be an anti-Semite because I object to Jewish religious leaders teaching that Gentiles are nothing more than animals, that the purpose of Gentiles is only to serve Jews, or the Talmudic injuncture to that if a Gentile hits a Jew, he's in effect hitting God. Well, ladies and gentlemen, certainly this is not my view of the world, and this is certainly a terrible and hateful view toward Gentile people. And if Jews have a right to bristle and to be unhappy about hateful things said about them as a people by Gentiles, then why in the world don't I have a right to be unhappy, and other Gentiles have a right to be unhappy, to object to this extreme Jewish fundamentalism, this Jewish hatred, this Jewish supremacism that is so powerful? These are not just some radical Jews running around in some settlements in Israel, even though they've made a lot of mischief over there. One of their leaders, of course, one doctor, actually killed dozens of Palestinians as they were in prayer in Jerusalem. And you know, and he was, by the way, given a hero's funeral. One of these Jewish leaders of the Chabad movement, of that point of view, stated, in fact, in the Jewish Week, which is the largest Jewish publication in the United States of America, he stated for his readers of Halakha law or Jewish law, he said that the Jews have an infinite greater value than Gentiles, and that if a Jew needed a liver, that it wouldn't be immoral to literally grab a Gentile and take his liver. I mean, my God, this is unbelievable. This is beyond any sort of racism that I've ever seen. You know, in the and I've read a lot about the Second World War. I've read a lot about German National Socialism. I've read a lot about the Klan movement. I've never heard of any legitimate leaders of the Klan or the Germans or any other organization like that ever make such hateful comments. You know, I go back quite often, and I mention this in Jewish Supremacism. I said, you know, that Hitler, it's true, in Mein Kampf, he talks about the Jews in Vienna, and he talks about these earlocked, unwashed minions that he encountered in Vienna. And he asked the question, he says, you know, are these Jews? And then he answers rhetorically, are these Germans? Well, let me tell you something. Jewish literature and the Jewish Talmud and these Jewish groups like Chabad Lubavitch, they literally are far more radical than anything Hitler said in Mein Kampf, because they don't say, are these Jews, you know, are these Americans, are these Jews? They say, are these Gentiles, are these humans? These are animals. And yet, people who adhere to this philosophy, and leaders and rabbis in this organization are preaching in the White House of the United States of America. Of course, I guess it's not so surprising considering our policy in the United States of America. But there's always been, and people talk today about the dual loyalty of Jews in terms of Israel and the United States. And I think one of the papers recently that exposed this, and the paper that's again raised tremendous cries of anti-Semitism, was of course the Walt Mearsheimer paper at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. And they talk about the fact that American policy now is being dictated by these anti-American Jews who are subverting America and who are leading us to a policy that's in the interest of Israel rather than America and harming this country. Well, today I'm going to talk about disloyalty, and this is not something new. The idea of a Jewish minority in a country going against the interests of the people of that country in favor of a foreign nation or foreign state, this is not a new phenomenon, and this is one of the factors that you've had opposition to Jewish power in the history before. Let's talk about it for a while. You know, historically, the most common term other than moneylender associated with Jews has been tax collector. Now, there are many examples all the way through the 20th century of Jews being the main instruments of tax collection that ruling bodies used to raise revenue. The Jewish historian Josephus, in his Antiquities of the Jews, tells the story of a Jewish tax collector named Joseph in the court of the Ptolemies, who was so ruthless and effective in collections. They bid twice the amount of anyone else for the right to collect taxes. In those times, kings often took bids from tax collectors, and the one who promised the highest set amount would obtain the commission, and he would keep for himself all he collected over the amount he promised to the king. Now, Joseph's success came in no small part from the fact that he would kill and confiscate the property of those who refused to pay what he demanded. Josephus described his success as, quote, stripping Syria to the bone, yet he showed no restraint in his praise. Quote, Joseph was a good man and of great magnanimity. He brought the Jews out of a state of poverty and meanness to one that was far more splendid. This is the Jewish historian Josephus speaking. Rulers of multicultural empires had often used Jews as administrators because the ruling powers knew that they would have no loyalty to the non-Jewish people of the lands where they resided. Jews made excellent tax collectors. They had good financial acumen, and they had all the required traits of all good tax collectors: little sympathy for the taxpayer. In the Muslim world, the practice of using Jews as occupying administrators can be seen in the Arab conquest and rule of Spain in the 8th to 11th centuries, in the Fatimid rule over Tunisia in the 10th century, in the Marinid occupation of Morocco in the 13th to 15th centuries, during the Mongol rule in Iraq, and in the 16th century Ottoman period. The practice has continued even into the 20th century. In Morocco, where the French used them in this rule over the Muslims, in the post-World War II satellite states, the Soviet Union, in Eastern Europe, and even, at one time, in the control exercised by King Faisal in Iraq. Now, one of the most repeated charges that anti-Semites have made is that in retaining loyalty to their own perceived group interest, Jews have historically betrayed their host nations in time of war, in time of occupation and hardship. Now, Byzantine history affords an example of a relentless conflict between the Jews and their host people during wartime. And by the way, just recently at the American Renaissance convention, I asked the question of one of the speakers about the internal threat in terms of opening the gates to Europe. And of course, over the last 30 to 40 years, Jewish organizations have been the primary forces behind opening the gates of Europe and America to this massive non-European immigration. In fact, it's not just the last 30 or 40 years. 30 or 40 years, I guess, that the gates have been open fully, but this goes back much longer. And by the way, I'm in a cafe here in Turkey right now during this program, and I'm sorry I missed the show last night, but so you might hear some background noise, but again, I guess it adds some atmosphere to the program. Getting the truth out is never easy, and it's a never-ending job, and I'm trying to do the job the best I can. I really appreciate your support because it makes it possible for me to do this. Well, anyway, during the Renaissance Convention, I just asked a question, a very simple question, and I pointed out that the last 30 or 40 years, they have, you know, the certain group, the non-European group, has really been behind this aversion in terms of opening our gates to the enemy. And the same group literally opened the gates of Constantinople and Granada historically. Well, I'm going to talk about that issue for a while. By the way, by saying this question, in fact, I didn't even use the word Jews. One Jewish individual, Michael Hart, got up and started screaming at me, called me a effing Nazi and all the rest, just for asking this, you know, legitimate question. And I tried to do it in a low-key way, and I was going to let the speaker answer. I was not going to get into a debate about it or anything. But I just asked a question because I was getting concerned about the idea that we've got to worry about this class of civilization when the truth is that enlisting us in the neocon effort is not, I don't think, the best thing for our people. This war in Iraq is insane. And this tremendous involvement we have in this worldwide terrorist war, which we're bringing on by our support of Israel, I believe, in so many ways. But when I said that Constantinople was betrayed, let's talk about that. And I can talk about specific times when Constantinople was, in fact, betrayed by the Jewish minority. Okay. Jewish writers, Gedalia Alon and Michael Avayona, show that Byzantine authorities prophetically feared that their Jews would aid Persian invaders. They also were correct in fearing that they would assist Muslim armies as well. Jews were killed in great numbers after the uncovering of a Jewish plot to deliver a city to the Persians. And by the way, you can get the documentation for all of this from my book, Jewish Supremacism. And that's available on my website, and I hope that all of you who have not read it yet will read it, but you can get the documentation and the sources for all these statements. Jews sided with the Persian invaders in the early 7th century, and in collusion with the Samaritans, massacred 100,000 Christians. When the Christian Byzantines retook the city, Jews were forcibly converted to Christianity. The Jews supported the Arabs when they conquered the area in 636 to 40. In the 12th century, the Byzantine Jews supported the invading armies of the Seljuk Turks. In 14th century, they supported the invasions of the Ottoman Turks, the final conquest of Constantinople occurring through a Jewish quarter with the active assistance of the Jews. In gratitude for their support, the Sultan imposed Jewish economic domination over his Christian subjects, and Jews immigrated into the area from throughout the diaspora. Now, those are the facts, ladies and gentlemen, the facts and nothing but the facts. A repeated time of betrayal. Now, a great deal of evidence exists that Jews supported the Saracen conquest of Spain and served as the harsh administrators of the Muslim occupation government. Jewish communities have aided the invader whenever they have seen an advantage in the overthrow of the existing order. Of course, Muslim societies have just as often been betrayed by Jews as have Christian ones. It's not just Christian societies that are betrayed. After the Second World War, Jews became the prominent administrators and secret police of the brutal regimes installed by the Soviets in Eastern Europe. In his 1981 book, Uprising, David Irving shows that Jews so dominated in the secret police that tortured and murdered hundreds of thousands in Soviet-controlled Hungary that anti-Semitism was one of the motivations of the anti-communist uprising. Considering the Jewish involvement in the murderous specter of communism, it should be no puzzle why the Jews accuse Eastern Europeans as being the most anti-Semitic. And again, that's got to be in quotes, that word. In Russia itself, Jewish communists were the forces that dispossessed the Russians of their own government, that made up the leadership of the murderous KGB, and who murdered the Russian royal family, including all the children. America experienced one of the most treacherous acts of treason in the annals of history when Julius and Ethel Rosenberg and their Jewish co-conspirators stole the American atomic bomb secrets and gave them to the Soviets. During the Vietnam War, the Jewish-dominated New Left led pro-Viet Cong demonstrations while American boys died from Viet Cong bullets and bombs. The two most famous of the Vietnam-era seditionists were Abbie Hoffman and Jerry Rubin. Jewish spies for Israel, such as Jonathan Pollard, have stolen some of America's most closely guarded secrets. His stolen secrets were then bartered by Israel to the Soviets, which devastated our intelligence operations in Eastern Europe. And by the way, mentioning the Vietnam War, looking back on it, obviously, I don't think we should have been in Vietnam. I don't see the American interest being in an Asian land war. But I want you to notice something. The opposition to that war in America was allowed and even promoted by the media. For instance, look at all the anti-war songs that we saw in terms of the broadcast and the radio. They were constant and never-ending. And these people and these ideas were made to be icons. In America, there's been a lot of music which has been made against the Iraq War and really kind of exposing it, but this music has been brutally suppressed by the Jewish control of the music industry and even radio stations, and they've done it. There's no argument about it. Isn't it interesting how when you have two separate wars, when Jewish interests are at stake, there's an entirely different way things are done. Talking about this disloyalty, and we talked about Constantinople, we talked about Spain, we talked about Eastern Europe, we talked about many things, but probably the classic example of their role as administrators and exploiters in oppressive government is found in their own chronicles. Now, that's the story, the common story, which most of us learned in Sunday school, which I certainly did, and that was the story of Joseph. Now, every Sunday school child is familiar with the biblical story of Joseph and his coat of many colors and his betrayal by his brothers, enslavement, and subsequent rise to great power in Egypt. When I was in college, a friend recommended that I read the account of Joseph and the Israelite sojourn in Egypt in the light of my new understanding of historical Jewish behavior. I took out my Bible and I turned to the last pages of Genesis and the first of Exodus. And after reading and reflecting on what I had read, I think I finally understood why God was so often put out with a chosen people. And I began to understand why, finally, God considered them to have broken the covenant, and he rejected them as the chosen people. And by the way, that's very clearly written in the New Testament, which anyone can check out. And again, you can go to my website and look up these quotes, and you can see exactly what I'm saying. In fact, the New Testament says it very clearly, they continued no longer in my covenant. Anyway, Genesis introduces Joseph at age 17, tattling to his father, Jacob, about his brother's wrongdoing. And Jacob is so taken by Joseph that he gives him a coat of many colors that evokes jealousy in two of his brothers. The brothers are also disgusted by Joseph's self-aggrandizement relating his dreams of his future superiority. In one dream, Joseph tells how he's in a field binding sheaves and how his sheaf stood up, whereas his brother's sheaves were gathered all around it, bowed low. Soon afterward, he relates a dream in which the sun, the stars, and the moon bow down before him. Even Jacob rebukes Joseph for a display of an insufferable chutzpah. His brothers hate him so much they decide to kill him and subsequently throw him down an abandoned well. However, when they see an Ishmaelite caravan bound for Egypt, they decide to sell their brother into slavery instead. Joseph's taken to Egypt and eventually sold to Potiphar, captain of the Pharaoh's guard. Joseph's glib tongue and financial acumen leads to his rise as overseer of an entire household. Potiphar trusts him with every detail. One day, while Potiphar is away, his wife cries out that Joseph's trying to rape her, and when the other servants come running, they find Joseph's clothes left behind as he fled. Joseph claimed it was he who was the victim of an attempted rape, but an enraged Potiphar throws Joseph into prison anyway. Again, using his cleverness and acumen, Joseph rises to become the top trustee of the prison and eventually runs the jail and has all the prisoners under his control. In the prison are several of the Pharaoh's servants. From them, Joseph undoubtedly learns all the gossip and goings-on in the royal house. Two of Pharaoh's servants, a butler and a baker, had dreams that Joseph cleverly interprets. The butler is eventually reinstated. But after the Pharaoh has a disturbing dream, the butler tells Pharaoh about Joseph's abilities. Brought before the Pharaoh, Joseph interprets the famous dream of the seven fat beeves and the seven thin ones. Intelligently, understanding the cyclical nature of prosperity and famine, he tells the Pharaoh that there will be seven good years and seven bad ones. Joseph then suggests the Pharaoh appoint a man discreet and wise and set him over the land of Egypt, Genesis 42:33. Pharaoh then makes Joseph the most powerful man in Egypt other than himself and has him gather up all the crops of Egypt. For the next few years, Joseph collects vast amounts of grain from Egyptian farmers and ensconces himself as the, quote, Lord of Egypt, unquote, ruler of Egypt, unquote, acting in the name of Pharaoh. When drought and famine finally hit, Joseph hatches a scheme to increase his and the Pharaoh's wealth and power. As the starving Egyptians appeal to the Pharaoh to get back some of the grain that they've deposited over the years, the Pharaoh tells them to go talk to Joseph. Joseph tells them that they must pay for the grain and gathers up all the money that was found in the land of Egypt. That's from Genesis 47:14. A severe depression occurs when the currency fails. Following are a few of the powerful verses. This is from 47:15, and the money failed in the land of Egypt, the land of Canaan, and all the Egyptians came to Joseph and said, give us bread, for why should we die in thy presence? For the money faileth. And Joseph said, give your cattle, and I will give you food for your cattle if money fail. 17, and they brought their cattle unto Joseph, and Joseph gave them bread in exchange for horses, and for their flocks, and for the cattle of the herds, and for asses. And he fed them with bread for all their cattle for that year. When that year was ended, they came to him again the second year, and said to him, we will not hide it from my lord how our money is spent. My lord also hath our herds of cattle. There is not aught left in the sight of my lord but our bodies and our hands. Wherefore shall we die before thine eyes, both we and our land? Buy us and our land for bread, and we and our land will be slaves unto Pharaoh. And as for the people, he made slaves of them from one end of Egypt to the other. That's in verse 21. So Joseph first takes away all the money of the free Egyptians, then their domesticated animals, then their homes and their lands, finally puts them back on the Pharaoh's new land as slaves, with 20% of their crop going to Pharaoh. The Pharaoh is ecstatic with this arrangement, his treasury is overflowing, and Joseph has taken away all the lands of the people and put them back on it, working essentially as sharecroppers. At the same time, the Egyptians are going through this misery. Joseph sends for and brings all of his Jewish brethren to Egypt. And Genesis makes it quite clear that Joseph gives the Israelites bags of gold and food, and that they, quote, live off the fat of the land. This is from 45:18. and take your father and your households and come unto me, and I will give you the good of the land of Egypt, and ye shall eat the fat of the land. 47:6. The land of Egypt is before thee, and the best of the land. Make thy father and brethren to dwell in the land of Goshen, let them dwell. 47:13. And there was no bread in the land at all in Egypt. The famine was very sore, so that the land of Egypt and all the land of Canaan fainted by reason of the famine. 47:27. And Israel dwelt in the land of Egypt, in the country of Goshen, and they had possessions therein, and grew and multiplied exceedingly. Now, one can imagine what the Egyptians thought about Joseph taking all their lands and possessions and reducing them to slavery, while the foreign Israelites are given gold, free food, and the best of the land in all of Egypt. The Egyptians had built a grand civilization with magnificent artistic and cultural achievements and advances in mathematics, engineering, architecture, astronomy, architecture, medicine. They had built the most enduring architectural creations in the world, the pyramids. How they must have chafed under the absolute power of this foreign tribe. According to Genesis and Exodus, the arrangement persisted for a long time, suggesting that the Israelites were the privileged administrators of Egypt during a very long period. The Pharaoh could count on them having no loyalty to the native aristocrats, the Egyptian aristocrats, or the merchant class of Egypt. And they might have served the Pharaoh's purpose by directing the wrath of the people toward the Jews rather than toward the Pharaoh himself. At any rate, eventually the numbers and political and economic power of the Jews grew so excessive that even the royal family felt threatened by their power. And by the way, that's a pattern that's often been repeated in Jewish history. Note the following passages from Exodus. This is from Exodus 1:7. And the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly and multiplied and waxed exceedingly mighty, and the land was filled with them. 1:8. Now there arose a new king over Egypt who knew not Joseph. 1:9. And he said to his people, behold, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. And 1:10. Come on now, let's deal wisely with them, lest they multiply, and it come to pass that when there falleth out any war, they join also unto our enemies and fight against us. So get them up out of the land. Now, then are recorded, of course, dutifully, the Egyptian pogroms against the Jews, and the Jewish celebration of Egyptian infanticide and Jewish expulsion and deliverance as represented in the Jewish holiday of Passover. The Egyptian pharaoh was not the last who sought to expel Jews from his land. Now, following is a partial list of the expulsion of Jews from European kingdoms. And I can give you a few here. Mainz 1012, France 1182, Upper Bavaria 1276, England 1290, France 1306, France 1322. Now, it's many countries repeatedly. They led back in and they expelled them again. Saxony 1349, Hungary 1360, Belgium 1370, Slovakia 1380, France 1394, France again. Austria 1420, Lyons 1420, Cologne 1424, Mainz 1438, Augsburg 1439, Upper Bavaria again 1442, Netherlands 1444, Brandenburg 1446, Mainz 1460, Mainz again at 1483, Warsaw 1483, Spain 1492, Italy 1492, Lithuania 1495. So I mean, we can go on and on, ladies and gentlemen, but it's a very old story. Now, Zionist leader Jam Weizman wrote the following about frequent hostile reaction to Jewish presence. Quote, whenever the quantity of Jews in any country reaches a saturation point, that country reacts against them. This reaction cannot be looked upon as anti-Semitism in the ordinary or vulgar sense of the word. It is a universal social and economic concomitant of Jewish immigration, and we cannot shake it off. According to the popular Jewish version of history, in every case, Gentiles were at fault in every conflict. After tolerantly allowing Jewish immigrants into their nation, Gentiles are accused of unreasonable hatred against Jews, who are depicted as blameless sources of economic and social benefit. Now, when I read of the hostility toward Jews in dozens of different locations and historical circumstances, it seemed analogous to a man charged and convicted of dozens of rapes in several states over the course of many years. The man claims he's always innocent and that the dozens of rape convictions were merely the results of an unreasoning hate that the victims had for him. One perceptive writer, Joseph Sobran, said it well when he suggested that the term anti-Semite no longer means someone who dislikes Jews. It now means someone that the Jews do themselves dislike. I also encountered a Jewish view of anti-Semitism. As I continued my reading, I discovered what Jewish scholars believe is the historical origin of the Jew-Gentile conflict. If one delves back into the pages of Genesis preceding the story of Joseph, one comes upon the striking story of Isaac and Rebekah and their two sons, Esau and Jacob. The Jewish faith claims these two sons represent the two separate nations of Jew and Gentile. And I will get into that over my next broadcast. I think it's some very interesting material. And we will continue with the roots of anti-Semitism. I enjoy being with you, and I certainly hope and would much appreciate it if you'd help get this program out across the Internet, across America, across the world. It's up to you. You can do it, and I'd certainly appreciate your help in doing so. It takes your effort, and I certainly appreciate your help in supporting these efforts and the publication of the David Duke Report and my work and travel around the world. It takes money. Most of the trips that I take have no financing at all for them from the local sources. Sometimes we get a little help here and there, but it takes a lot of money to travel and to speak and to promote and to teach. And I make very money, little money, in fact, when I do teaching in Eastern Europe, almost nothing. But I do it because it's important, because it helps bring a whole new generation of people, leaders, in fact, up to date with the knowledge that they're going to need in their lives and their countries are going to need, because their countries are going to need good leadership that have a complete understanding of this problem. It also gives me a chance to keep my fingers in the soup, you know, to keep an understanding and abreast of things, and also to hear objections and to hear different arguments. So it keeps me sharp and available, and it certainly, I've got a lot of material to put into the next editions of Jewish Supremacism and My Awakening, and I'm working very hard on that, in fact, at this time. So I much appreciate your help in getting this material out. Well, thanks again, and I'll certainly look forward to being with you on Monday. Bye-bye now. This has been David Duke.
This has been a David Duke Worldwide Web Radio broadcast. For more information and to support our vital work, please visit www.daviddude.com.